Fuck you, James Cameron. I ain't got nothing against the man.
No, neither. He's put some good films on the screen.
Yeah. He's definitely not a Michael Bay.
Hello! Welcome back to This Is Backcountry.
HK.
This is episode 3.
I'm going off Sean Connery.
I was going for a Dutch Steve McLaren, but yeah, fair dues.
Well, hello Dutch Steve McLaren.
Actually, I should do it in German. He's just gone to Wolfsburg to manage them. Yeah.
Are we talking football?
Nah, we're talking film. This is Backcountry.
So, hello Tim.
Hello Paul, how you doing?
I'm good, mate. I'm good. I've had a good week. How are you?
Good, yeah. It's a lovely sunny day.
It is. I've had a lovely week not watching Inception.
Mm.
Yeah, as you'll as you'll remember from our last podcast, we mentioned that Inception would be out, and it bloody well isn't. So.
Not for another 8 days.
Yeah, the official release date for Hong Kong is the 29th. So apologies for that one if you went to the cinema looking for it, like me and the missus did.
Yeah, you talk about that.
Yeah, we went to have a look, and weren't there, and I got very angry that it wasn't there. I was like, "Oh, this cinema shit is only showing like you know Shrek 3D,
yeah.
and Predators,
God Twilight, in four different theaters, you know."
And at that point, I just like, "Come on, let's go and eat something." Not realising that Inception was
Yeah, well, I only found out because I bought the latest Empire, and it's because we get the Australian Empire down here, being close to Australia and Hong Kong shit, and they don't get it till the 22nd, and we don't get it till the 29th. It's just, I think, the US and maybe big places like the UK it'll be out.
So yeah.
A few of you lucky ones out there may have seen it already. Feel free to write in and let us know how it is. I mean, I'm sure it's going to be great.
Yeah, speaking of which, we've only had one email so far, and it's something we can't really read out.
So. It's just something about extending our manhood by a few inches.
Yeah, it's
pretty cheap as well.
Yeah. So what are we going
to talk? We had an email.
Yeah, we did. We had an email from your mate from Japan, didn't we?
Oh, Hugo. Yeah, cheers, Hugo. If you're out there listening, we thoroughly enjoyed that. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Actually, you know what? We should read it out next time. Just because it was our first email and no one has even bothered to email us since you guys. So, cheers, mate.
Yeah. Except those, you know, as I said, those Viagra guys, they're well keen on us.
Those Nigerians.
Yeah.
You know, I better help them out next week when a paycheck comes. Yeah.
Hey, how about this? If we do really successful by the end of the year, we'll give those Nigerians just a little bit of money.
Yeah, and maybe you go as well.
You scratch our back, we'll scratch yours.
Yeah. Anyway, we should kick this off. We're going to talk about some films we've watched recently.
Hmm. What did you see the other night?
Leaves of Grass.
Leaves of Grass. Yeah, I saw that as well.
Edward Norton film.
Yeah, Edward Norton and Edward Norton.
Yeah, he plays two twins.
That's like, right.
Two twins. He plays a pair of twins.
That's better.
Well, he plays twins.
For God's sake, make up your mind.
He plays some twins. One of them is... well, they're both geniuses, but one of them is an academic. He's head of classical philosophy, isn't
That's
he?
Right, yeah. At Harvard or MIT are one of the big ones.
It's one of the big ones, but he gets offered a job to create his own...
Design his own course, that's right, yeah.
For Harvard. And all these things start to get in the way. He gets called down to where he's from, Oklahoma, I think.
Yeah, well, basically, he's like a little country kid who's made it out because he's like smart and academic, but his brother's been sort of left behind in the sticks. And
but his brother's a genius as well.
That's right. He's actually got a higher IQ than he does. It's stated in the film.
Yes, and what happens is the guy left, the twin left in Oklahoma, gets a message to Edward Norton. Well, to his other twin that he's dead. You know.
That's why he goes down for his brother's funeral, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's a con.
Oh, well, his Hick brother, is
a drug dealer.
He's and a pot grower. Small to medium time pot grower. Yeah, he's basically the. I don't know. I don't know. He's
like
very
the
good.
The Stephen Hawking of.
Yeah, 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 yeah. As he likes to refer to his setup, it's like the Taj Mahal of green of weed greenhouses. So he's borrowed a lot of money off a gangster to build this massive setup to build high grade blaze. But then that's when the problems start kicking in, and he drags his brother back into it, right?
Yeah, and Edward Norton does a stellar job playing two different characters. You see the movie. And you see the differences in the characters and the way they interact on screen. Fucking brilliant.
He really does show his versatility, and it's one of the reasons he's my favourite actor. He's been in so many good films. And he's really shown in this one he can play highbrow intellectual and hick Oklahoma weed grower.
And he plays the hick part brilliantly.
He's my favourite character in the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's Billy Kincaid.
Yeah, Billy. And Brady's the brainy one, the academic.
Yeah. It ends really bizarrely, though. That it just sort of ends really quickly.
It's...
It just kind of stops. And, yeah.
It just gets a bit weird. It's pretty formulaic, I gotta say. It's one of these... coming home stories, as I like to call them, you know? Like, kid has sort of gets away from his past, especially if you've grown up in, like, underprivileged, you know, redneck country. You can see why, is it Brady?
Brady.
Brady's gone away. You know, he's found his escape route from his trailer trash roots. But, you know, he comes home and he falls back in love with redneck life and sees, like, a different side to it than sort of, like, how he was... his skewed view of his past, I guess, his memories.
Yeah.
He comes back down. It does help that there's a love interest, you know, a southern love interest. Kerry Russell from Felicity, the TV series, for one thing.
Don't know it.
Back in the day, I'd catch it on a Saturday afternoon sometimes. So. Anyway, moving on. She was also in August Rush as the mother, the cellist playing mother. She's a good actress. Remember, she does the catfish noodling.
Yeah, she's kind of like a tomboyish character. Shows Billy how to live. Is it Billy or Brady?
I'm getting confused.
you just watch it.
Yeah,
and you'll see just how good it is until the end. And it's got Lucy DeVito in it as well.
Oh,
Danny DeVito's
so weird. Daughter.
She looks
weird.
it's like the cross between a munchkin, Danny DeVito, a hobbit. And an Oompa Loompa.
Yeah, God.
And she the first couple of scenes that she's in, she kind of half goes topless, and you're like, no, don't do
that. Who does she play again?
She's one of the students that wants to rape Brady.
That's right.
She just wants to get in his pants, and that's where all the trouble starts, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because that puts his Harvard thing under jeopardy, because one of the professors finds out about it and mentions it to the Harvard people. And
yeah, yeah, yeah. Or he gets... She barges into the room for, like, a end-of-the-year review or something, or a homework paper review, and ends up confessing her love in Latin.
Yeah.
And stripping off and jumping on him, and then, like, secretary walks in or something. Someone sees it, yeah. and then soon after, he goes back down south. But, I mean... It's got an all-star, not all-star cast, but a really well-put-together one, actually. I mean, just off the top of my head, we've got Susan Sarandon, plays the mother of the twins.
Yeah.
She's a bit of a troubled character.
She's the ex-druggy mother who, at the age of, 50 or something, she checks herself into...
old people's home.
Old people's home, because she has freedom to do whatever she wants.
Yeah. Well, I think she was part of the hippie revolution, and that explains a lot about the boys... upbringing and where they are now, especially Billy, you know, who's like grown and dealing drugs.
And he's very good at it.
Yeah. Oh, he's, yeah, like you say, Stephen Hawking.
Yeah. What's the name of that guy who wrote it?
He starred in it. He plays Billy's friend, Tim Blake Nelson.
Yeah. And he was in Incredible Hulk.
He was the scientist in Incredible Hulk.
The scientist who, is it Mr. Blue? The guy who's on the computer trying to help him.
And that's it. Yeah.
And yeah. Eventually gets obsessed and creates the abomination.
The abomination. Yeah.
Tim Roth.
Yeah, he's also in No Country. Sorry, Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
One of the prisoners.
That's right. Yeah, it's three of them. Clooney. Yeah, and John Turturro. Mm. But yeah, not only does he star in this, he wrote it and directed it.
Ah.
Which I was very impressed by, because it's not a bad film, as we said. It's a bit weird towards the end, but...
It's quite philosophical as well.
Yeah, yeah.
If you watch it, you'll realise that there's a lot of philosophy thrown in there, because, I mean, Brady is a philosophy aficionado.
Yeah, professor. But even Billy, which is what I liked about it, sort of like is able to explain complex thoughts into a very layman perspective. And he's supposed to be the hick, weed-dealing, you know, free spirit. He shows that he does have a deeper side to him as well. The two are very different, the two brothers, but there's a lot of similarity you can see as well.
Because there's one scene where they both get high. Brady gets high for the first time in years, and Billy starts asking him about his book. Brady tries to explain it to him as if, like, Billy's a professor of philosophy, and Brady breaks it down into things like, so what you're saying is, if the duck eats the bread, he will not go hungry.
Yeah.
Not that exact line, but that kind of...
Yeah. Trying to boil it down to basics.
Yeah, so that...
So
that I can understand.
Yeah, it's quite funny. It's just like, oh, I read your review about that boy's book about a review, and it's like, yeah, what'd you think? It's like, I just thought it was kind of ridiculous that you ran a review of someone else who written a review. It's like, well, very well done, Billy. You just basically described academia in one succinct sentence. And it is quite funny. It's true, you know. It's like,
it is. It was a good, solid film. Watch it for yourselves.
Oh, it's an incredible effort. And apparently Ed Norton took a big pay cut to be in it. He wanted to be in it. And apparently Tim Blake Nelson wrote it with Ed Norton in mind.
Mm.
I think I collaborated on a few things. I'm really glad Ed took the role, because there's not many actors who could have pulled it off with the same sort of panache, you know. Big word.
I hope it gets released in Hong Kong.
I'd love it to, but I doubt it. I think it's going to be one of these indie flicks that flies under the radar.
Yeah. I haven't heard a lot about it.
No, not at all, actually.
I mean, the only reason I heard about it was because I was looking through his film... Well, I was looking through his Wikipedia page, because... my girlfriend is absolutely in love with him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I was like, wow, what films can we watch with Edward Norton in?
As long as it's got Ed!
Yeah. she loves a bit of the Ed
Keeping
Norton.
The Faith? That's a sort of enjoyable rom-com.
Yeah.
I like that. Yeah. Ben Stiller as well.
Ben Stiller.
Yeah, what's happened to that kid, man? He's a kid. Hardly a kid anymore.
Well, he's just done a recent film called Greenberg, actually.
Okay.
Which I watched the other day.
Oh, you've seen it?
Yeah.
Well, tell us a bit about it.
It's an odd film. It's a film about a man who's in his 40s.
Aye.
And he's had a nervous breakdown. He goes to LA to his brother's home from New York. And what he does is he looks after the house while they're away on holiday.
Okay.
And he's just trying to get his life back on track. Really bizarre.
Oh, shit.
It's really bizarre.
This is not a comedy.
It is, but in a really odd way. Lots of really awkward kind of real-life situations happen where awkward people interact. And...
Yeah.
I mean, there's an interaction with this girl that he's just met. They're both super awkward people, really shy, introverted, and they just start babbling about shit.
Sounds like a Friday night for me.
And then they end up having sex.
That's where the comparison ends.
And then she stops him halfway through.
Oh.
They decide not to have sex and to share a beer and finish it. And then...
Is she still into him? Is that awkward? I mean, that seems awkward to me.
It is really awkward. Like, they like each other, and then they spend the rest of the movie deciding whether they should or shouldn't be together. He gets very... I can't think of the word. He just gets really possessive, and then really elusive. He's just all over the place.
Oh,
but I think it's one of Ben Stiller's best roles ever, because Ben Stiller for me isn't a quality actor, and I actually enjoyed Greenberg.
Ben Stiller's, you know, for me, he'll always be the guy in There's Something About Mary, who with his homemade hair gel, you know. But isn't it funny when these comic actors take on serious roles, but actually win a lot of credibility for it? Like, I don't know if you saw Adam Sandler's Punch Drunk Love.
No, never
Sounds
saw
very
it.
Similar. A sort of dark comedy about just a loser who's like on the verge of a breakdown. Does have sort of dark, you know, darkly funny bits, but generally a story about someone who's just trying to get their life together and sort of does by the end.
Okay.
And he's really good, actually. Jim Carrey's another one who's like crossover, you know.
Mm.
And what would you give this out of five? Let's say that.
Out of five, Greenberg. I'd give it about 3.5.
3.5, that is.
Risa Farns is really good in it. A Welsh actor.
Oh, Notting Hill.
Yeah, Welsh pride for you there,
yeah.
Tim.
Oh, yeah.
And he's really good in it. He plays Greenberg's best mate. They were bandmates together when they were young, and they spend a lot of the film together just trying to sort out Greenberg's life, because it's just gone down the shitter. But one of the lines I really liked in the film, Reese Fans says, you know, youth is wasted on the young, and Ben Stiller just, whilst he's chowing down into some food, not even looks up, just says, I like to think that life is wasted on people. Genius line, but it's just wrapped in a mental film. Mm-hmm. If you watch it, you'll understand what I mean when there's a lot of inane bullshit going on, and then they deliver a couple of quality lines about life, about people, about how people deal with their lives. And
so it's a very profound but quite cynical comments.
Yes. It's very downbeat. Very downbeat. And it ends. It's another one that ends bizarrely as well. It just stops.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but
sometimes I like that, though, when a film can challenge you to sort of work out where it's going to go on from. It leaves you after a critical point. And I don't think you need to be fed endings. I think Hollywood is just assumes people are retards most of the time, and they have to feed you a picture-perfect ending. You know, there's a lot of films which sort of leave you hanging on the edge. The character's made a vital decision, and it's like, from then on, their life will be different. But it's kind of up to you to imagine where it'll go from there. I don't know if this is one of these examples.
Greenberg is a perfect example. Kind of like The Wrestler.
Oh, I haven't seen that yet.
Well, it ends without any conclusion.
Oh, no resolution?
None.
No.
None whatsoever.
But have they at least run the course of a lot of the narrative threads in that?
Yeah. Well, with The Wrestler, Greenberg seems to stop and doesn't know where it's going to go, leaving it up to you. And I can't really say I know where it was going to go.
Fair dues, fair dues.
But yeah, about a 3.5 if I have to go with a rating system, and I don't go with rating systems at all. I think they're bullshit as well. But
we can pause it if you want.
Yeah, we could.
Just getting some tea.
Okay.
Or water.
If you can't hear that, Tim's getting some tea. Well, who else is in Greenberg? It's written and stars. Well, it's written by and stars Jennifer Jason Leigh.
What's she big from?
She was in Existence. The one with Jude Law.
I haven't a clue.
It's a bizarre film. They can pull guns out of their bellies, and I think it's just weird. It was
okay.
I don't even know what we're talking about. We could probably cut that out.
All right, Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Yeah, so she writes and stars in it, and she's the odd girlfriend that he sort of has, and that's all I've really got to say, really. I don't have much respect for Jennifer Jason Leigh. She hasn't really done much of worth, so
I see. Well, you know what? Just because it's Ben Stiller, and like I kind of like to see actors breaking out of the mould, I'm going to give it a chance. Because Adam Sandler impressed me in Punch Drunk Love. Jim Carrey, if you haven't seen The Majestic.
Haven't.
That's good. That quite a serious film, but, you know, not comedy, and again, he's impressed. I have to say, Jim Carrey, he's pretty good when he's in a serious role, I found, because Eternal Sunshine is one of my favourite films. Like, that's wicked film.
That's a beautiful film.
A lot of that is down to Michael Gondry, and the chemistry between a lot of the other players, the smaller characters. It is a great film, isn't it?
The memories when they're going back with Kate Winslet. Yeah. And
do you remember the house when it's like falling apart? So sad.
I love that bit.
Yeah, because he's just like, he's decided he can't live without her and he's desperate to get her back, but she's like literally running away from him in his mind, and like he's about to lose her and forget her forever. He's just like chasing after the last threads of her existence in his mind. It's so sad.
It's a beautiful film. Very tragic.
Yeah.
And also very positive at the end, I guess.
Yeah, it makes you kind of believe in love again.
I think it's definitely up there with 500 Days of Summer in one of those films that you need to watch after a really, really messy breakup.
Yeah.
Just to give you some hope. Jesus Christ.
Yeah, we know it's tough times out there, kids. So, you know, give yourself a bit of sunshine.
Hmm.
Wow. Eternal sunshine. The mind.
Shut up, you damn. We have rambled on a bit. We should get things going.
Aye.
We are going to do a profile this week, and we've decided to do it this week on Mr. Stephen Chow. If you're not familiar with Stephen Chow, he is Mr. Shaolin Soccer.
Aye, Kung Fu Hustle, probably his two biggest and well known in the West.
Yes.
Yeah, he's like Hong Kong's golden boy of the '90s.
He is. Well, we can just start from.
Let's start at the start. Yeah. He was born the 22nd of June, 1962. So that would make him now about 48.
Yeah.
Wow.
And he's a handsome chappy.
Looking good for 48.
And may he continue with his blessed looks.
Yeah, it's them Asian genes, you know.
It is. I mean, he's going grey now, but he looks fantastic.
Okay. Right. Well, you do.
Sorry, I was speaking into my cup there. He looks fantastic.
Every week there's once.
Go fuck yourself.
But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of that down is down to his discipline. Like, he's an avid kung fu lover, so he practices as well. I think that helps him keep his a good figure.
Well, Wing Chun, he's a.
I think that's it, yeah.
Is the word proprietor? He's a proprietor of Wing Chun.
I think that would mean he owned Wing Chun.
Yeah.
He's a practitioner.
Practitioner, there we go. Practitioner of Wing Chun.
That's what Bruce Lee started out on, and I think like Jet Li and Jackie Chan.
Well, Bruce Lee created Wing Chun.
Did he?
I think so.
I'm not sure.
I think that was what he...
I think Bruce Lee is Jeet Kune Do.
Jeet Kune Do.
Yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
No, I mean, it was quite revolutionary because he studied Wing Chun extensively, you know, like a lot of the other greats, and a lot of other disciplines. And what Bruce did was Bruce, that's how I call him, he brought them together. He merged them into this beautiful, seamless fighting style.
Yeah.
And Stephen Chow sort of held him as an idol.
A massive idol, because he homages him in so many movies. He's not a bad role model.
It got him into acting in a lot of ways, I think. Because, the kung fu comes through in a lot of his films. But let's go back to the start. Okay, so what can you tell us about early Stephen Chow?
Early Stephen Chow, well, he was, like John Woo, he was from a poor background, a very poor background. When he began training in Wing Chun, he took 6 lessons before his family realised they couldn't afford to go anymore. So, being an absolute genius, what does he do? He goes, you know what, I'll watch some fucking films and I'll learn that way. Why not?
So, yeah, it's like, don't they do that in, you were saying that earlier, a Bulletproof Monk? Is that Sean William Scott?
Sean William Scott and Chow Yun-fat. Yeah. Sean William Scott becomes the greatest kung fu artist of all time because he studies Bruce Lee movies. And it's like, okay, Stephen Chow actually did it in real life. You're just a Ponzi white boy pretending in a shit film.
Yeah.
Sit down and make Dude, Where's My Car again.
Yeah. Oh, dear.
I don't have a
no love, no love for Sean Williams.
God, he can go sit on a cock.
All right, back to Stephen.
Not on pork sauce, but yeah, back to Stephen Chow. We are waffling. Continue, sir.
Okay, well, before we get onto the big ones, Kung Fu Hustle and Shaolin Soccer, again, like the bigger ones known in the West. I mean, I had mates in uni, my film course, and knew that, but they didn't know any of the early ones or the big ones like God of Cookery. You know,
that's a brilliant film.
Yeah,
God of Cookery.
God of Gamblers too. He was cast in
with Andy Lau.
Andy Lau. Yeah. That's it. But for that one, actually, that was his breakout role. He'd been in a lot of, well, he started off in sort of the TVB acting school, and this would have been about the 80s, like just before his big break. So he had a lot of supporting roles in films, a couple of Johnny To action films, John Woo action hit films, like Just Heroes in 89, Dragon Fight, and that was with Jet Li as well.
Ah.
Yeah, but he was never the male lead until later on. And it was this film, All for the Winner.
All for the Winner.
In 1990, when he was about 28, which was a parody on the original God of Gamblers with Charlie and the Fat.
Yeah.
And that was a sort of breakout role. And it was that led him to be... He plays a guy called Ah Sing.
which, funnily enough, Sing is his Chinese name.
Hmm. Yeah, doesn't he always play a guy called Chao Sing Cho?
Most of the time.
Which is his real name as well, isn't it?
Sing Chi Chao, I think.
Yeah.
I can't get the turns right, so I probably said something like fried vegetable, cheese, air conditioner.
My favourite. he always plays this guy, and then he's a guy with a poor sort of mainland guy with ESP, extrasensory perception. So he just cheats at card games and gets really good at gambling. And because it's a parody on God of Gamblers, he gets really good in that. But it was so good. It was so successful at the box office in Hong Kong. It broke the previous record, which was held, ironically enough, by God of Gamblers.
didn't they do a sequel, God of Gamblers 2?
That's right.
With Chow Yun-Fat as well?
Yeah, and as this character from the parody film, they drafted him into the franchise, which is a big props to that,
yeah.
To him.
He's just very good at comedy, so why not
draft
him in? But he suited the role really well.
Mm. Have you seen that one, God of Gamblers?
Not the first one. I got the second one on VCD.
Oh, sweet, yeah. And I think they went on to do a third even. When they went... It's like God of Gamblers back to Shanghai.
Really?
Yeah. And it's got Charlie for Andy Lau and Stephen Chow.
Oh, right.
It's like all three of them reunited together. I haven't seen it. This is, it's all on the grapevine. Stephen Chow's got a very particular kind of comedy.
Slapstick.
It's generally slapstick. The locals have a term for it.
I don't know.
It's a special brand called Mo Lei Tao. And my pronunciation is way off there again. I probably said like dirty Chinese whore or something. But it literally translates, or loosely, to makes no sense.
Ah.
And you know, it's a very satire type of comedy that works like very quickly on a wordplay. Non sequiturs, you know, and just like silly to the camera comments where, you know, they do it in comic books sometimes, especially like Deadpool, if you ever read that, where he'll like turn to the reader and say a comment like kind of cheekily.
Yeah, a bit like Wayne's World.
Yeah.
What are you doing? We're the only guys who can talk to the camera. Hey, camera, come on.
And like, what were we watching earlier? That Stephen Chow film, Justice My Foot. Where he plays a lawyer in like Ming Dynasty China or something.
Yeah.
And it's just like the first time you see him, the crowd splits and he's like dressed in his like garb and with this massive, ridiculous fan going
everywhere. He looks like a complete bender, really.
Yeah, and he plays this typical arrogant, cheeky character who's quite full of himself, a little bit megalomaniac.
That is his trademark. He does it in a lot of his films.
Yeah,
he starts off as this very confident, full of himself.
Yeah, definitely
egomaniac, narcissist.
Yeah. Well, like God of Cookery, for example, Shaolin Soccer.
Yeah.
Again, like
Kung Fu Hustle, especially. He thinks he's a gangster, and he's just a tar.
He's a street rat, isn't he?
Yeah. And in God of Cookery, he is the God of Cookery, and then it's found out that he can't actually cook.
Yeah. Well, the God of Cookery, very quickly, is a parody on local cooking shows, on how local TV chefs were getting really big. So when they call him the God of Cookery, he's supposed to be this TV presenter type celebrity, right?
Yeah, who judges other
lesser mortals.
And he gives them all zeros in this contest because the texture's not right or there's too much salt, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
and then he gets to the last one who makes a perfect meal, but he gives him a zero because he's ugly.
He's too ugly, yeah.
he says, oh, this would be a perfect meal, but you're ugly and I have to see your face. Now when I eat it and I see your face, so I just feel sick. Zero. And then he gets kicked off his pedestal all the time.
Yeah, that's it.
Brought down, back down to earth, face first, fucking stamped into the mud.
Yeah. And quite, not just metaphorically, but literally often.
Yeah, and he has to bring himself back to a position of power or achievement or ranking and status by, being humble about it and realising that he's not the top dog. And that's another trademark of his films, that sort of storyline.
Yeah, the sort of, what do they call that, redemption story.
Yeah.
You know, he falls down and has to learn the error of his ways and how to be dignified and humble to regain the status or skills he had before.
Raging Bull.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, or Shawshank.
It's a very common, archetype? I don't know. Very common
theme
cinema.
Stephen Chow does it through comedy, and that's why he's loved so much, because he does everything with such a straight face.
Yeah, real deadpan delivery sometimes.
The deadpan is brilliant in God of Cookery, especially when he's interacting with Karen Mok. Turkey.
She's like the noodle vendor who's also like a triad on Temple Street.
By the way, that was my slip up of the week. I need to have one every week.
Oh, it keeps it interesting. We're still human.
And
I still take a shit every day. Sorry.
Sometimes 4 or 5. It depends how fibrous I've been. But his interactions with Turkey in God of Cookery are spot on, proper deadpan, and there's that one bit where she takes a bullet from him.
Yeah, that's well into the story.
Yeah, and she's going on about how much, you know, she likes him, and, you know, she's been his fanboy for such a long time.
Yeah, number one fan.
And the whole time he's just... this complete deadpan, just like, it's not going to work out between us and all this, while there's, like, shots of her, like, horrific, horrific teeth.
Oh,
I don't know why I went horrific there. Horrific.
Yeah, she's made out to be pretty ugly. She's got these buck teeth, a big scar from, like, her eye down to her cheek. It's from, like, a gangster fight on Temple Street.
Yeah.
Yeah, and she's like his number one fan, and throughout the film she's helped him out. She sang him like a really sweet, dedicated, like karaoke version.
Karaoke style love song.
Yeah. It's like, I am your buddy, I work hard for my buddies. And he's just like, nah, no thanks. Like, anytime there's any romance between them, you're like, oh, what's that, a UFO? And you'll jump in a cab and like drive off. He's a harsh bastard, Stephen Chow.
Yeah. But his face is just so perfect for that deadpan style of comedy. Yeah. Think like Charlie Chaplin.
Yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, and then he'll break out into like a Jim Carrey-esque moment where it's like he's got this rubber face that just like pulls some crazy expression in there. Or he'll karate kick someone like through a wall. Like earlier in God of Cookery when that fan comes up. Like, ah, oh, UFO! And he kicks some guy like
it's the fan that appears in quite a lot of his films. It's the man dressed up as a woman.
With a finger up his nose.
The little finger up one of his nostrils with like lots of lipstick on.
Yeah. He's in loads of films, like From Beijing with Love, like God of Cookery. I think he's in Shaolin Soccer.
He appears throughout. He's one of Stephen Chow's close friends who is kind of half in, half out when it comes to acting.
Oh, right, really?
Originally, that role they wanted, and they didn't have a female, so Stephen Chow just asked his mate and said, look, can you do it? Well, they didn't tell him what he was going to do. They just said, can you do this part? And he said, I'll do it for you, Steve.
Sweet.
Yeah, I'll do it for you, mate. And Stephen Chow just went, yeah, all right, wicked, get into a costume.
Here's your lipstick, here's your dress.
Got him done. And he doesn't really have any lines. He just kind of walks up, smiling to Stephen Chow, picking his nose, looking like the worst tranny that has ever lived.
Oh,
he's a great recurring character there.
Yeah, yeah. It's good to have him as well. Good to have him.
Shaolin Kung Fu Sing Ho Ho Yeah Shaolin Kung Fu King
Hai Ho Gun
Wo Hai Ti Tao Gong
Mo De Ti Tao Gong
Li Hai Gam Gong Tai
Hai Gam Gong Tai.
I didn't even listen to what we were talking about. What were we talking about?
We were talking about the tranny.
Oh, in all his films, the recurring character.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, if we're talking about recurring characters, his best mate his best mate in the film world, who keeps popping up.
Mantap.
That's the one, yeah.
I'm not sure if I said that right.
That's how a European would say it. Like they say Ji-Sung Park, you know, yeah. The Manchester United midfielder. Which really annoys me because in Asia it's Park Ji Sung.
Yeah.
And I think it's written.
Mantap.
Yeah, but I'm not sure because is quite a common Chinese surname, right?
It is. It is. But he's the older guy.
Not sorry to be pedantic.
No, don't worry. You corrected me on my Chinese. he's in Justice.
Oh, the one we just watched. Yeah.
He's the dog at the beginning. And he's in Shaolin Soccer as... Oh, who does he play?
He's the coach in Shaolin Soccer.
Is he?
Yeah.
No, he's not.
Yeah.
No, he's the accountant brother. The guy who ends up being the goalkeeper at the end.
No.
Yeah, surely not. The one with the stomach.
Yeah. I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, it's him.
Let's check it up.
Oh.
Kung Fu Hustle or something. It's just the Shaolin Soccer.
Golden Leg Fun.
Yeah, the coach. Golden Leg. Remember he has his leg broken?
Hold on. Let's go. Where's it?
No, it is this guy. Because that's another one. A lot of the people are recurring. Because remember God of Cookery?
Yeah.
Man Tatton is the guy who smokes cigars, who was like employing him, you know, they were partners. And then he screws him over with some other guy, some younger guy.
Ah, yeah, there we go. Shit, yeah.
Okay. No, I mean, I think Stephen Chow, because especially with God of Cookery, he directed that, I think. He got behind the camera for that one.
Ah,
he was one of the first. And then he also might have a producer credit. So he's got a big say in it, and he likes to use this same ensemble cast.
Mm.
So the guy you were talking about, the accountant,
yes.
Who's the stomach guy.
Yeah.
He's in Justice. Yeah.
And I don't think he was in Kung Fu Hustle, though.
He might be. It's been such a long time since I've seen it now.
Yeah. But Man Tat is the coach, Golden Leg.
Yeah. And he's a funny character.
He's brilliant. He starts off as being the guy who...
He's the assistant to one of his former teammates, who's gone on to become one of the best players in the world.
And then
one of the best coaches. But he's an arrogant prick, and he's corrupt. It comes out later that he paid off Golden Leg to miss the penalty, which subsequently caused a riot that got his leg broken and his ended his career. And then he's on the coaching staff, but he gets fired. So he becomes like a beggar, right?
Yeah, and that's when he finds Stephen Chow and decides to start a team.
Yeah, eventually. There's a bit of scepticism about Stephen Chow's abilities in the beginning. Stephen Chow's this like really naive character, actually. Chow in soccer, there is this arrogance. Well, there's this self-belief again, but he's less arrogant. He's almost more naive.
Yeah, he is naive in that film.
It's really funny. He's like, Shaolin soccer, let me teach... No, Shaolin Kung Fu will save the world. Like, it will help your job. Let me teach you. And they're all like, fuck off, mate. And he's like, oh, that woman would learn to park cars better if she knew Shaolin Kung Fu.
Yeah, that is a brilliant film, Shaolin soccer. And it's the film that really made him a worldwide name.
Yeah, I think that is the international breakthrough for him.
Because at the time it was the most I'm talking shit.
Box office.
Yeah, the box office. It was the the biggest Hong Kong film.
Oh really?
Yeah. Ever at the box office.
Whoa! Oh, you locally? I think all over Asia did quite well. Thailand is a big market for Hong Kong films.
Yeah.
And so is Taiwan. It did very well, award-wise. I think Stephen Chow did a sweep of the, not just him, but the film, at the Hong Kong Film Awards. He got Best Director, Writer and Actor.
Yeah.
And it was, yeah, it was definitely one of the biggest of that year for the box office. You're right, it's international breakthrough as well. Followed, was it 4 years later, I think, in 2004, by Kung Fu Hustle?
Kung Fu Hustle, yeah. But it says here... ranking the highest grossing film in the history of Hong Kong cinema with a record of Hong Kong 60 million.
Sure.
That was Shaolin Soccer in 2002.
2002.
Yeah, and then Kung Fu Hustle, I think that eclipsed it, didn't it?
Yeah, I would have thought so. Brilliant film, Kung Fu Hustle.
Kung Fu Hustle is absolute genius. Really good parody of local Chinese people. And yeah. the landlady and the landlord especially.
Yeah. They're all caricatures, yeah, probably. She's the loud mouth, like always down your back for like not paying rent and like in your ear. And her superpower is being able to shout really loudly. Which is genius.
She's the fag smirking, angry, pissed off at everything landlady who can beat you down in a second.
Make you feel worthless.
Well, actually, we watched a little bit of it recently with the missus, and you know, she's a Cantonese speaker, and a lot of the humour is lost in the translation.
So I've been told, but I don't speak Cantonese either, so I really don't like watching dubbed films. I've seen a couple dubbed, but what I like is to get the original Cantonese speaking, and then just reading the subtitles.
Yes.
But I've been told there is a loss. A lot of the comedy lost in translation.
The thing I found was when we were watching it, is I was reading the subtitles and laughing. But she'd carry on laughing because they'd say something else.
Yeah, wordplay and that.
Yeah. And it upsets me that my Cantonese is bad, that I can't get those insider jokes. But that landlady, like, everything she does is comical. Absolute brilliance. That there's a guy who's at the beginning of the film who's complaining. He's complaining that there's no water, so he can't shower.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Out in the main courtyard because it's a poor community.
Suburb. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the little hideaway places in China.
Shanghai, I think it's said.
Yeah, Shanghai. One of the boroughs that is really, really poor, so they share the shower, and he starts complaining that there's no water, and she just comes down after beating her husband, and just slaps him, and, like, knocks him out. The guy's bleeding on the floor.
Oh, dear.
And she's just, like, telling everyone how useless they are, and, like, the tailor, who's a little bit camp, she's constantly calling him fairy boy. She's like, oh, what do you want, fairy boy? And then he runs away like...
Yeah, I remember that, yeah. I think that's another one of these ensemble recurring players. Like,
He is, because he was in Shaolin Soccer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And, but the landlady, Yuen I think. Or Q.
I'll tell you a word for it.
UNQ. She was in Man with a Golden Gun at the age of 18.
Yeah, the Bond film.
Yes.
Damn, that's crazy.
Yeah, you had something to tell me about that, actually.
Oh, the only thing I know about Man with a Golden Gun in Hong Kong is in Wan Chai, there's that bar where a scene was filmed, Bottoms Up Club. I think it's one of them girly bars. Yeah,
where there's pole dancing places.
So I hear on the grapevine.
But yeah, she was in the movie, at the age of 18, spacked her career. And then she retired for a while in the 80s because she got married.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. And then she took her friend to an audition for Kung Fu Hustle. And her friend was auditioning for that landlady part. And she was stood at the side of the stage or wherever auditions were being held. And she was stood there with that purse that she has in film where she's got her arms crossed. She looks grumpy as fuck. And she's got she's got a fag hanging from her lip.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she's just puffing away, looking like a complete bitch. And Stephen Chow just saw her and went, "That is the landlady.
I'm having her." Yeah,
yeah. He's like, "Well, not that one."
I'm having
like,
a bit of that.
Yeah, he's like, "I want her as the landlady and
private audition in my dressing room right now."
Well, she took the part.
Oh, she took the part.
You dirty fool.
Stephen Chow is actually rumoured to have had a couple of secret loves with some of his leading ladies.
Not really secret. But
I don't know. Apparently they did find their way into the public limelight eventually. But Karen Mok was one, because she's been in a lot of the films. I love Karen Mok. She's a real local beauty and she's got a lovely smile and I got a soft spot for her.
Isn't she in her 50s now or something? Oh, she's almost 50 or something, right?
She'll be his age and he's 48, right? So she'll be, I don't know, mid-40s.
Okay.
She doesn't look a day over 25.
She doesn't.
And I think, credit. I think another one might be Cecilia Cheung, now the wife of Nicholas Che.
Nicholas Che.
That dick who crashed his Ferrari and blamed it on someone else. And then crashed another Ferrari a week later, and he got done for both of them, and done for lying.
Yeah.
Anyway, sorry to interrupt you. Stephen Chow's
secret loves his wandering fingers. Once again, the phone has interrupted.
Sorry about that.
These are becoming our little trademarks, aren't they? Fucking hell. But yeah, to get back to
Bought some Tronky.
Is that one of those chocolatey snacks?
Yeah, it's a lovely chocolate. It's a chunky chocolate bar. It's not even...
Tronky.
Try it. It's not chunky. It's a lovely blend of several chocolates.
Well, speaking of chocolate, UNQ to gear up for a role as landlady for Kung Fu Hustle, Stephen Chow wanted her to put on weight. So she went, "All right, fair enough." So she just get up in the middle of the night and just stuff herself silly. That's it.
Yeah. That's commitment to a role.
If that's your job, to just wake up in the middle of the night and be like, "You know what, I could murder some ice cream." Yeah. That would be awesome.
Mate, midnight snacking and it's just part of your role. Oh, man.
Just get yourself down some Mars ice cream.
Yeah.
Oh, that gooey caramel scent. Anyways, let's get back to the show.
Yeah, sorry, Stephen Chow. Oh, what you were saying earlier about Shaolin Soccer being and Kung Fu Hustle sort of what got him known in the West, yeah?
Yeah.
It's strange because he was Hong Kong's golden boy in the 90s. He was in a lot of big films, either as a supporting actor, and then eventually he got his own, from Beijing with Love and all that.
Mm.
It's strange, though, because his brand of comedy, this, this sort of slapstick, self-referencing, pop culture referencing. And as you said, a lot of the comedy is lost in translation. That's why it took so long, I think, for him to have the international breakthrough. because some of it is so specific to Cantonese culture and language. It's wordplay. You know, you said a lot of the jokes, your girl was just like laughing on and on after you, because she probably had read like another few layers into the comedy, where we would have missed it as just sort of coming from the Western perspective.
Yeah, because we're Gwilers.
Yeah, Gwilers.
We are
white ghosts.
Yeah, we are. And you know, as such, we miss a lot of good things about Hong Kong, and especially Hong Kong cinema. I mean,
yeah.
we can't comment on it as real locals, even though you've grown up here your own life.
That's true. No, I'm very aware of what I lose out in that, and it makes me a bit sad.
It does, because, I mean, if you're listening to this and you're not local to Hong Kong, you're not a Hong Kong local, you will find Stephen Chow to be funny as fuck, but you'll miss out on about at least, I'd say, about 40% of the humour.
Yeah, it doesn't mean it's not enjoyable, it just, I think, we do lose out a little bit on that.
We do, and it's such a shame.
Yeah.
It's why I should get my Cantonese going, because, you know, you don't have any excuses, you know, you're Korean, Welsh, I'm...
Yeah, but I grew up here, though. Chinese, true.
Well, moving along there, he did make it big in the Western world. Kung Fu Hustle was highly sought after.
Oh, yeah, that solidified it. Like, as I said, I had a couple of friends who knew about that in uni, and I was happy with that.
Well, apparently in North America, it wasn't released for quite a while.
Really?
And people were looking for pirate copies.
No way.
Yeah, and it got such a cult following through pirate copies until it eventually did get released, because it got set back quite a bit.
Yeah, sure.
For the American release.
Okay.
I don't know why. I don't know. Maybe you guys can let us know if you're listening and you have an insight to it. But, yeah, apparently there was an issue with distribution and getting the release dates finalised. So a lot of the American kind of Asian fanboys... tried to, you know, got it through illegal methods and... They still went out and, you know, watched it in the cinema and bought the DVD.
That's so cool, you know.
Yeah, and for a man who's built his career around very specific comedy for a very specific audience, we are a tiny, tiny island.
Oh, aye.
To get that big is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's real credit. And to have that cult following overseas, where people are just doing whatever it takes to get a film, you know, because it's not in the cinemas... So they have to turn to illegal distribution channels. Now, we're not advocating that, but I'm saying
that's dedication.
That's freaking awesome.
And that also shows just how far Stephen Chow's gone from being, you know, starting out his acting career as a kids presenter on TVB Pearl to having fanboys in America trying to, you know, get a hold of his latest film.
That's awesome, mate. That's Oh, I think he'd be real proud to know that. He must know it by now.
Yeah.
I hope he does.
I hope he does as well.
If he's listening, he will. I doubt it.
I seriously hope to God he's not like the characters that he plays in the film where he's an arrogant prick. I really hope he ends up being like the guys where at the end of the movies where he's come from rags to riches.
And realises what he has finally. Yeah.
And you know what? I think he has, because he was very poor when he was little. One of his quotes, which I thought was really, really sweet, was, he said, "I was very poor. As a child, my dream was to have a leather football."
Oh.
I know, it breaks your heart, doesn't it? And then now he's so celebrated. He is one of Hong Kong's absolute golden boys.
He can buy all the footballs he wants.
Yeah, and I hope he did. I hope with that the first time he got on TV, he went out and he went, yeah.
He bought
a leather football and did one of those Anchorman jump in the air mode. So they're like, new suits. Yay!
Or that bit in Shaolin Soccer when the soccer team's getting really big and then Puma like, "Thank you very much for sponsoring our products," and they just like punch the guy in the face and just start raiding the wall for all like the free shoes.
Yeah. Oh, what a legend.
Yeah.
But I sincerely hope he's like that, because
I hope so
too. It'd be a shame to find out he's like Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, it's all gone to his head, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of quotes here that I thought were really, really cool.
Shoot.
Let's see. He said, "I used to cry when I watched Chaplin's films. It was from him that I learned about the role of the underdog. And because I'm also from a poor family, this kind of thing moved me, and I found that it also worked for the audience because most of them are like me. Ordinary guys."
Nice.
Sorry, ordinary. Ordinary. I said ordinary. Ordinary.
Aye. I didn't even perceive a difference, but...
I did, because, you know...
That's a real nice one, actually. I think, well, hopefully that does show that he's found some humility in his stardom.
And he pays homage to a lot of his idols in his films. You know, there's Chaplin, obviously, with the slapstick humour.
Yeah.
Kung Fu Hustle, there's a lot of references to The Matrix there.
Yeah, that's quite evident. But apparently a lot of other films as well.
Yeah.
In Kung Fu Hustle.
Mm. Well, Matrix Reloaded is the fight scene at the end when he's taking on all those people that look exactly the same.
Yeah.
It's like, when Neo's taking on Agent Smiths. And, because there's lots of them in
That's
there.
That's right, yeah.
And then...
finishing each other's sentences.
In that same thing, he's... paying homage to Bruce Lee, because he's wearing the costume that Bruce Lee wore in a previous film.
Yeah, that's right.
One
of his characters in Shaolin Soccer, the goalkeeper, is wearing a Bruce Lee outfit, and does all the Bruce Lee actions. Like, a lot of the time, goalkeeper does the flick of the nose, the sort of angry, come-get-me glare. Very Bruce Lee.
Yeah, and the biggest homage they pay to him is when the goalkeeper gets taken off when he's injured. He's in the pose that Bruce Lee was in when he was laid out for his funeral, because Hong Kong people do open casket.
That's right.
So that you can pay your proper respects. And as he puts himself in that pose, someone puts the Bruce Lee aviators on.
He slaps on the Bruce Lee aviators.
And lies in that pose. Oh, what a tribute to a Hong Kong legend.
Definitely. And like one of his heroes.
Yeah, one of his heroes. And if Hong Kong has, like, if you were to say the number one hero for Hong Kong, it's Bruce Lee.
Aye.
Yeah. But speaking of Shaolin Soccer, at the time, Shaolin Soccer was banned in the mainland because censors, they didn't like the fact that they'd combined Shaolin with soccer, because they thought combining temple names and sport in a movie title was like an insult to Buddhism. And Chow refused. He refused to change the title. He stuck to his guns. And for that, the mainland banned him from filming there for a year.
Really?
For a year.
Wow.
But I'm glad it wasn't any longer, because then we wouldn't have got Kung Fu Hustle.
That's right. It also set on the mainland Shanghai.
Yeah. And Kung Fu Hustle, like we were saying before, has lots of homages. There's a reference to Spider-Man when Donut is on his deathbed.
Oh.
He says, "With great power comes great responsibility," which is, paying tribute to Uncle Ben.
Yeah, he says that to Peter Parker when he's dying.
Yeah, which basically starts the whole Spider-Man legend.
Yeah.
And what else? There was a tribute to Brian De Palma's Untouchables.
When was that?
1989.
Yeah, I mean... In the film,
it's... I think it's done after he says those dying words. He grabs someone, I think, and in the same style of Sean Connery's character, is it Jack? I think. He grabs him, and he says in English, "What are you prepared to do?" Like he does, like Sean Connery does to Kevin Costner, and I won't try the accent, because I can't do Scottish. But, yeah. Absolute brilliant homage, and there's a lot of local ones as well that we won't know. It's all about previous Hong Kong films. If you're curious about this, you can find this homage. It's online. Just have a quick Google search.
Yeah.
But to end with Stephen Chow, I guess, I got a quote here, Mr. Tim Tim, that sums up his entire body of work.
Well, don't tease me, Paul. Lay it on.
All right, I'll stick it in thick and fast. he says, "Right from the beginning of my work, I wanted to capture a mass audience, and I love the unusual. You never see dancing villains. For me, there's a fine line between comedy and drama, so it's not just played for laughs. There's a little romance in this story too, something for everybody. And you could say that about all his films.
Yeah, that really sums up his mission statement when he goes out to make a film. That's nice. And dancing villains as well. I mean, that's a great scene in Kung Fu Hustle when they got...
with their axes.
Yeah, an axe gang. Dancing. And they're all dancing on the streets with axes.
Actually, just to end, my favourite scene ever in a Stephen Chow film is in Shaolin Soccer, when he's talking about how he wants to be a footballer. He wants to progress.
Yeah.
And that guy in the stand at the bun shop, he stands up and he's like, "Oh, that guy sung a beautiful song to that woman. I want to be a singer." So he starts singing a song.
Yeah.
And then it goes to another guy and it zooms into his eye and he's like, "That guy singing and dancing, I've always wanted to be a dancer."
Yeah.
And he's fat as fuck. And he just rips his shirt on of these man tits and jiggling everywhere. And it's the worst dancing song ever. And they all get...
They all start choreographed dancing. Yeah. It's like, what's going on here?
And it's brilliant. And I guess...
so funny. The little boy is so weird with his, like, bum fluff mustache. And it zooms right into his iris.
And the fact that we can just laugh talking about this sums up that quote for me, you know? That there's something for everyone in this Stephen Chow film.
And even if it's Cantonese, a lot of that translates, and it has done to a Western audience.
His comedy transfers to, you know, people young and old as well. I mean, in a lot of his films, there's Looney Tunes references, there's references from really old films, new films, his own films. It's just a kind of comedy that you can really embrace, no matter how old or young you are.
Mm.
So, Stephen Chow is now and up.
He's been inaugurated into our cinematic wank bank.
Yeah, our cinematic wank bank.
So here's the Hong Kong's golden boy.
Yeah, well done, sir. Welcome, Stephen Chow.
Bobo's got excited. Do you think something's going on?
All right, so we're finally going to talk about something that we believe is important to the industry right now, the movie industry. And I'll start with a quote from a guy called Hiroshi Yoshioka, who is the executive deputy president in charge of, consumer products at Sony.
Okay.
Which may give you a little clue onto what we're going to talk about. He says, "We expect demand to be strong for our 3D Bravias this summer. We also expect the 3D TV market to grow to around 100 million units globally over the next 3 years. Now, he's talking about 3D TVs here. 3D TVs and 3D movies. And during his speech at the National Association of Broadcasters show, he talked about two films that were what he said were kind of the stalwarts for
3D cinema. At the moment, yeah.
And he mentioned Avatar and Alice in Wonderland. Mm. Now, we've talked about Alice in Wonderland before, and we both agreed that for 3D or not, it was pants.
Hmm.
And for the technology, you mentioned you'd seen it in 3D, and you said...
That's right.
What did you think?
Well, basically, I just thought the 3D was very gimmicky. Unlike Avatar, it wasn't filmed stereoscopically, meaning two cameras. That's how Cameron achieved the effect, the very lifelike effect. Alice in Wonderland was transposed from traditional celluloid or digital onto 3D using various techniques, and it doesn't translate as well, for one thing. And secondly, their decisions on when to use the 3D, I thought, were very gimmicky.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you've already mentioned how you feel about it, but what movies have you seen in 3D?
Those two films are the ones I've seen. Avatar was the first 3D experience I had.
And how was it?
I loved the experience. It was awesome. It was really immersive. It was just, I think part of it was the charm of the world that Cameron had created, you know, this Pandora. If you don't know Avatar, you know, it's this human, it's like a Pocahontas story, you know, but like it's this human who inhabits this alien's body, and he just rediscovers this beautiful landscape, and it's such vibrant colours, and the 3D really did lend towards that.
Oh,
it was a really cool experience.
Whether that can be translated onto a home TV system, though, is gonna be... Oh, it's already a big hot debate, isn't it?
Yeah, because it depends how big these TVs are going to be. I mean, if they have the smaller scale models, say, what, 20 inches, 25
yeah,
inches?
It's really not going to be that impressive, is it?
No, it's going to be it's going to be like watching a, I don't know, watching a video game.
Yeah.
Kind of a little bit more smooth around the edges.
It might pop out a bit, but, I mean, how are you really going to be able to tell on a monitor that small?
Yeah, and then... How expensive are the big TVs going to be? 40, 50 inches?
Well, that's basically where this technology is really going to start having an impact. Yeah, like a 40-inch, 42, let's say. And it is these Bravias. Like, they're lovely TVs. We've seen a couple of flat screens in our time, haven't we?
At home, I have a Bravia. Not HD, but I have a Bravia from the old days.
And how big is this bad boy?
I think it's... 35, 40? Oh, 38.
Okay, well, staring at it now, it's a very respectable size and a nice big screen. Good to watch like a nice DVD or Blu-ray or play some like state-of-the-art computer games on.
Yeah, and it's not HD.
Yeah.
It's not HD. I haven't upgraded to a HD TV yet, so I don't know how Hiroshi Yoshioka is expecting there to be 100 million units sold globally.
Well, in 3 years, they said. So we're talking 33 million a year. That seems like a really ambitious target for me.
It does.
I mean, like you said, your average TV owner might not have an HD TV, but they've got a relatively big one, right?
Yeah.
Or at least they're rocking something that has been in the house for a while. I don't know if I can see that many people taking the leap to 3D. It seems like a real risky venture for an average consumer.
And the price is ridiculous as well. There's talk of... the first couple of TVs costing $12,000, and this is from an American website. So I'm gonna speculate and guess
that's US. Yeah, no, I mean, for $12,000, you can make a great HD TV.
A HD projector twice and have two projectors like making a big fuck off screen in your entire house. Why bother?
Yeah.
Paying for a 3D TV.
That's 12,000 US. We're looking at like 86 Hong Kong. 86,000. No, you can get like a home cinema set up for something close to that, you know, a cheap one. So I just don't see it. People taking the risk. I mean,
at least not in 3 years, because the prices will still be expensive.
That's right.
Plus, you've got the added misery of having to wear those fucking glasses.
Yeah, which aren't exactly comfortable to begin with.
No, I mean... I don't know how it is because I don't wear glasses myself, but people who wear glasses, if they don't like wearing contacts, they're going to have to put their glasses underneath.
That's right, yeah.
Then if they do wear contacts, are the contacts going to affect the technology as well?
It's just another headache in the whole process of this. I mean, for me anyway, I think it's the same with a lot of TV viewers. TV is an escape. It's something that you get home, and you can just sort of like watch but not watch. You know, you just tune out. You're just watching anything on the tube. You just want to relax after a long day. Now, for me, the idea of having to sit on my sofa, put on glasses, but not only that, probably have to sit dead on center to get the full 3D effect, which means that you can't properly stretch out as you would on your sofa, you know, like legs off the end.
Yeah.
And as you like to. I don't see it. I really don't see it being a comfortable experience.
That, and I, like you said before, I feel like it is a gimmick.
Definitely.
I've watched two films in 3D.
Which two of those?
The first one was Coraline, which is it's a Neil Gaiman film. Flew completely under the radar of a lot of people. And Coraline was absolute genius. It was a brilliant film. The only bit I actually felt like, wow, the 3D's really added to this was at the beginning where someone's stitching a doll and this needle came right at me and I fucking freaked. I did, because I didn't realise what was going on. I'd forgot I was watching a 3D film.
Yeah.
But then after that, it didn't add anything else to it.
I see. So you didn't find it was like a seamless blend? It was just...
No, and I didn't feel like it made it any more immersive. I was immersed in the story because it's Neil Gaiman, who's a quality writer.
I was just going to say, I brought over prequels and Nocturnes.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
Preludes and Nocturnes.
Preludes and Nocturnes, sorry. Sandman series. Brilliant, mate.
Mm. Neil Gaiman is a brilliant writer, and I just felt that movie, it didn't need to be in 3D.
I see.
And I have watched it after that on a VCD and on DVD, both without 3D, and I got the same experience.
Fair dues, yeah.
And the second film I watched was Christmas Carol with Jim Carrey.
Oh, yeah. I heard that was very gimmicky use of 3D.
They had this one scene where Scrooge is being whizzed through a town so that he can go and see himself when he was a kid.
Yeah.
The Ghost of Christmas Past.
Oh, yeah.
And it did feel like a huge gimmick. It's as if they put that scene in there so they could go, oh, look, you're whizzing through the air with him.
Yeah.
And actually, the people I saw it with, one of my friends started to feel sick and got a headache. My girlfriend actually went to the toilet, puked, and then blacked out for a couple of minutes.
Oh, dear, oh dear.
Because we were sat quite close to the screen. Yeah. And, you know,
this is not the first I've heard of people feeling nauseous and uncomfortable. This brings it back to what I was saying. In the cinema, especially on a massive screen, if you're not sat dead centre and like halfway up the seats, you don't get the full experience, and it can be nauseating. So what's it going to be like at home if you have to sit dead on centre? You get 10 people around for a film, right? The people at the sides, at the periphery, are not going to be getting a good view. They're just going to be feeling like I'm wasting my time, and even worse, they might feel sick.
But yeah, and what are you going to do if you've got your house set up in a certain way where you can't watch the TV straight on centre because you've got furniture in the way, you've got other things to think about.
That's right.
So you sit on a side where it's kind of tilted a little bit, but not enough so that you're losing visuals or anything, and you're fucked.
It just seems like there's going to have to be so many concessions made for the viewer to enjoy this 3D TV that it's ruining TV. It's ruining what TV's supposed to be about. Just relaxing, being able to enjoy watching something.
And it's ruining cinema as well.
I think so. I think 3D is such a gimmick, and it doesn't really add that much more than a good film should be able to give you.
Mm. It's drawn in crowds, it has.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what the cinema executives, you know, the... Yeah, they want that cash money. And
cash money, I like it.
And they're not... Cash money, yes. And they're not... It's not going to be a long-term solution to the fact that there's other ways to watch films now.
Yeah.
So they're trying to cash in on this 3D thing in the at home. They're going to try and, you know, branch that in with Blu-rays. Certainly we're talking about modifying the PS3s. You know, there'll be updates for people to download and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't see the point.
From what you're saying here, it does scream of, like, the old hands trying to dig their heels in and reinforce their position. Like,
stubborn fuckers.
Stubborn, yeah, because they're losing money to new media rather than moving with the times, right? They're like record companies, they're trying to like hold on to their stars and their rights.
Yeah, they're clutching at straws. But the thing you've got to understand though is that these people, they are human beings and they want to be rich, they want to be successful, they want their money. And if they're being scabbed out of it, they are going to walk around like a wounded animal. They're going to snarl and bite everything.
Yeah.
And
nice way to put it.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's all about money for them at the moment. Because, I think the point I'm trying to make is they've got to look at their content now. They can't blame technology. They can't now say, well, the internet is killing us. Home entertainment is killing us. Fucking bite the bullet and put out some decent shit for once. Then.
Yeah.
Stop giving us dross made by 15-year-old teenage girls for 15-year-old teenage girls.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
The you've got to play to your strengths. And if the distribution companies and, you know, like the big ones like Fox, Paramount, Warner Brothers, if they want to keep up with the times, they've got to put out good content. Stop churning out the same shit.
Yeah.
Stop making remakes. Halloween, 80 million. stop putting out the same fucking film.
No,
every
they will.
Year.
That's the problem with this technology. It feeds into really gimmicky, really cheesy, really easy to make films like sequels. There will be another Halloween, and you know what? It'll be in 3D.
Yep.
Mark my words, Halloween will be one of the biggest 3D film bonanzas. So will Christmas, and so, unfortunately, I feel, will the summer blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so great to see a film like Inception, which is concept-based. You know, it's a really fleshed-out concept film, and I haven't heard a single rumour linking it to 3D releases, and I'm fucking thankful for it.
Yeah. Speaking of which, yeah, look at what Christopher Nolan's done. He's taken basic cinema, you know, he's taken basic filmography, cinematography, sound, all that. Yeah. I can't remember anything from that film. He's taken it and he's used it to make some beautiful films. And other people have as well. I mean, look at Michel Gondry. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. What's that film about sleep? Signs of Sleep.
Yeah, I've seen that.
Beautiful film. You should check it out because it's all just using standard film and standard cameras, and just interpreting it in a different way.
I see.
There's no gimmicks there. It's using what's there before, what's been laid before by all the masters, and just manipulating it. What they're trying to do now is give us new technology so that we can be spoon-fed more boring shit that we don't want to watch, because we're a generation of bored adolescents.
It seems like, yeah, with this generation, it's always the latest gimmick to keep us on our toes. We're spoilt with technology because we've grown up with it.
And we should all have ADD at this point.
I'm not surprised that it's on the up, because you've got kids growing up staring at screens, and when they're not staring at a glowing rectangle, they're thinking, what am I supposed to do now? It's like, well, you've got a life to live, mate. If you're a kid, you should be studying or socialising or learning skills or just being out in the world, right? If you're an adult, you've got responsibilities, or pick up a book or just interact with a human or an animal, something breathing and living. Honestly, this is getting onto a rant about technology. It does surprise me how these glowing rectangles have taken over our lives, and this is the newest gimmick to keep us staring at one.
Indeed. And I mean, the whole ADD point I was trying to make was that, you know, like you said, these kids have so much in their lives now. They're on the computers and they're chatting away on MSN. Someone fucking texts them, and then the Facebook update goes on their fucking iPhones.
Yeah.
Whilst they've got the TV in the background, music in the fucking ears. And what are they doing? They're streaming some movie, downloading something else so that, like, when that task that they've got to do is finished, that they can move on to the next thing.
I know.
And 3D TV is just going to be another one of those gimmicky pieces of bullshit that's just going to feed into this suck generation of there we go. So, as I was saying, it's just going to feed into this sub-generation where kids are just so bombarded with shit that they don't really need. What's wrong with paying money to go watch something at the cinema and have that collective voyeuristic experience of a film?
Yeah, exactly.
And come out of the cinema and talk to people that you've never met before and be like, that film was fucking ace. Or, that film was the shittest film I've ever fucking seen. I want to stab out my eyes with pencils. No, you're going to sit at home with these fucking stupid goggles on, trying to look around the back of the TV going, can I see up that girl's skirt? Because that's ultimately what 3D will eventually come down to.
It's a shame. And I think 3D TV is something that will come and go. And we will probably... It is cyclical. I think they tried it in the 80s. They probably tried it in the 90s. They're trying it now, and they'll try it again. But hopefully it will be when I'm old and tired and not wanting to look at a TV anymore.
Yeah. Well, they tried it with Hitchcock.
Did they?
They tried it with Hitchcock. I think it was Dial M for Murder.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, it didn't fly then. It's not going to fly now just because the technology's more advanced. Nah, it's bullshit.
And it's something we can live without.
Yeah.
It's a boycott 3D TV. It's expensive and it's fucking rubbish.
Yeah.
And 3D films. Anyways, we should end there because this one has rambled on for quite a while.
Hi. Yeah, thanks for sticking with us. We'd really appreciate it if you joined the Facebook page we got now. This is Backcountry HK.
Yeah, you can search us there. You can also find us at our email address. This is backcountryhk@gmail.com.
And we're on Twitter.
Yeah, we've got a Twitter. You can search us there. We're BackcountryHK because Twitter apparently won't let us have This is BackcountryHK because it's too long.
Is it?
Yeah, so fuck Twitter. No, we're on there. We're on Twitter and, catch us there as well. And if you want to seek us out on Facebook, send us a message. All right, take it easy.
Yeah, cheers. See you next time.
Same bat time.
Same bat channel.